So along this sort of journey that I was on, it became clear that most deep fakes involve, when it comes to online, almost all of them are pornographic in nature, intimate images, pornographic videos, and almost all of that time, 98, 99% of those images involve women. So it occurred to me, if you're going to try to get the biggest bang for your legislative buck here, go after the biggest problem. So although the bill is relatively narrow, this first bill, which deals with deepfakes, it was going to capture so much of the imagery being generated now online.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to Regulating AI, a podcast that brings global, diverse global voices to the important conversation around creating fair and equitable regulations for artificial intelligence. Today, we have the honor of speaking with Congressman Joe Morelli, who represents New York's 25th Congressional District. Congressman Morelli serves on the House Appropriations Committee and is the ranking member of the House Administration Committee. With vast experience as a legislator and a deep understanding of the implications of AI, Congressman Morelli is uniquely positioned to provide valuable insights into the ongoing efforts to regulate this rapidly evolving technology. We look forward to an engaging discussion on this critical issue. Welcome, Congressman, to the podcast.
Thank you, Sanjay. It's great to be with you.
Wonderful. Congressman, as I mentioned, we have a global audience, policymakers, think tanks, industry, et cetera. And generally, they would like to know what sparked your interest in AI's regulation, if you can just tell that to our audience.
Yeah, I think my interest really started probably more than a decade ago. I was a member of the New York State Assembly, which is the legislative body in New York, and I was serving as majority leader. And I had been talking to people about it. We didn't really refer to it as AI in the day. It was really about what we called CGI. You'll remember, computer-generated images. And I don't even know that the term deepfakes had even been employed in those days. We really talked about who owns someone's likeness, who owns someone's image, because it's often regulated state by state. In New York, a person could bring a civil right of action against someone who used their image for commercial purposes without their approval. But it didn't apply to people's estates. So when someone passed away, like Marilyn Monroe, had she been domiciled in New York, her estate would get no say in how her image was used, what would happen to the dollars that were raised commercially by using her image. And so I started really to think about this and whether I thought that was appropriate. Fast forward, I arrive in Congress in 2018. There's actually no federal standard, no right of property right assigned for someone for their image. So I started working on it at a national level, how to do something in the federal space. In the course of that conversation, what became clear is now we use the phrase AI and generative AI in particular when it comes to creating images and the use of the phrase deepfakes. And so along this sort of journey that I was on, it became clear that most deepfakes involve, when it comes to online, almost all of them are pornographic in nature, intimate images, pornographic videos, and almost all of that time, 98, 99% of those images involve women. So it occurred to me, if you're going to try to get the biggest bang for your legislative buck here, go after the biggest problem. So although the bill is relatively narrow, this first bill, which deals with deepfakes, it was going to capture so much of the imagery being generated now online. And the interesting thing, which you know, I have to tell you, Sanjay, is that over the last decade or so since I started down this, the technology to be able to allow you to generate images that are deepfakes, that are without the consent of a person, has gone from being relatively high-powered software and hardware to basically being laptops now. And the depiction of people in videos and photographs, et cetera, is so lifelike. Whereas 20 years ago, if someone Photoshopped an image, you could pretty tell that you could tell that, right? The images would look slightly different. The shadows would be off. I mean, a human eye could almost detect when something had been altered, an image. That's no longer true. So whether it's celebrities, unfortunately, what happened to Taylor Swift, or it's just individuals. And, you know, we've spoken to young women whose images have been changed. And so that's how this legislation that I've drafted, the use of preventing deepfakes in intimate images act, came to be. It was, how do we get the most impact for our work? And I felt this was a good place to start.
Well, Congressman, you raised some many important points, if I may follow up. One is the issue of deepfakes, and you referred to the Taylor Swift moment, which was really important. And then also you had talked about the conversations that happened in the New Hampshire primary. A few questions to you. First, obviously, we would like for our audience to know, what are the key provisions of the Preventing Deepfakes of Intimate Images Act? And how does it aim to address this issue? What are the penalties? What are the issues? If you can first talk about that, then I want to talk about this New Hampshire issue a little bit too.
Yeah, and I should just say, by way of background, so you mentioned that I'm on the Appropriations Committee. I'm also the ranking Democrat on the Standing Committee on House Administration. The interesting thing about that committee as it relates to AI is, first, it has responsibility, that committee, for overseeing federal elections, so the Elections Commission. And to your point, there has been clearly the use of technology in a way that is violative of fair elections by using the president's voice in a voicemail. Being able to regulate federal elections and the practices is one way that my committee intersects with the question of AI. The second is that we have responsibility for the Library of Congress, the Copyright Office, the Smithsonian. So when you're talking about huge data sets and making sure that they don't get contaminated, how do we make sure we're curating data? That's another part of my committee's responsibilities. And I could talk about that, but that's how I started getting drawn into other elements of AI. But the Preventing Deepfakes of Intimate Images Act does a couple of pretty basic things. It says, if you post deepfakes of a pornographic nature, whether it's photographs, videos, without the consent of the person being depicted, then you have both violated the criminal statute. We would make it a federal crime to do it. And it would also trigger a private right of action. So you could be held liable in a civil lawsuit. So it really tries to get at this and not only compensate people who have been victimized, but hopefully create a deterrence factor so that people would be less likely to post these images online. So we wanted to be able to have a comprehensive approach. There have been different proposals. And I say, I introduced this, reintroduced it last May, had introduced it in the previous Congress. So when the Taylor Swift issue came up and then the incident involving images of hers, we had already introduced this bill for a couple of years, but it really helped crystallize for people in a really tangible way what the damages are that can accrue from having your images posted without your, well, first of all, without your consent, but also in videos and photographs that you didn't appear in, that someone has taken your face and put it on someone else's body.
That's on that front. Now, coming to this whole message that went out to New Hampshire primary voters in the voice of President Biden, call it voter suppression. This was a Texas firm, and they used Lingo. And then the company that actually does the voice modulation is Level, I think, 11, I think. What are your thoughts on that issue? Because I know you said a lot of things here. I just want for our audience, because you were one of the first out of the gate to talk about this, and you really brought this to everybody's attention.
We really live in an interesting time, and I mean that in the best of ways, that given technology that we have today and the technology that's being developed, there's really a whole new world, and the speed at which technology is being developed and innovation is happening is at a speed unlike anything we've ever seen before. But you can use that for good or you can use it for ill. And what I'm really concerned about is in elections and the fact that we've seen American elections be undermined. I mean, the former president continues to insist to this day, 3 years plus after the election, that the election of 2020 was stolen when there's no evidence, no credible evidence has ever been supporting that. So that's something that's frankly a lie. And this being able to perpetuate now, misinformation, disinformation to the masses through social media and other means is really alarming. And people of both sides of the aisle are rightly concerned about misinformation and disinformation being spread. And certainly AI used in a malign way can do that and can really accelerate this. So I want to continue to pursue efforts that would make it a crime to use AI to misinform people about elections. And we're going to continue to work at how we work with the Federal Elections Commission and others to establish ground rules on what is and what's not appropriate. I mean, to some degree, using an elected official's image has been part of, since you could do Photoshopping, people have used it inappropriately. I think there's a line, though, between sort of exaggerated images that are clearly intended to show sarcasm or tended to portray something, but that the person watching it or the viewer would know, well, this is an exaggeration to make a point, and there are legitimate First Amendment considerations here. But then there are other times where it's clearly intended to demonstrate something that they want you to believe actually happened that's misinforming or, in some cases, outright deceit. And those are the most problematic and those are the most troubling. And certainly what the audio file in question that happened in New Hampshire, where it purported to be President Biden telling people not to vote, which is a form, to your point, of voter suppression, is highly troubling and really ought to be something that can be pursued by law enforcement or private right of action. In my view, it ought to be both. I think that's the only way you really get at this situation.
Congressman, you've been a leader on this issue. So just, we are in a critical election year, and there's elections in 60 countries around the world, and they're all kind of watching us. So your point is image photoshopping has been there, but here AI is taking you to the point of influencing potential voters in terms of some way or direction, which I think is an important point to make. The other aspect that I wanted your feedback is there are three players. There is a company called 11 Labs, which does the voice modulation. Then there is, I think, a company called Lingo. And then there is this person who bought the stuff and disseminated that stuff. Where, according to you, and it's not an easy question, where does the liability lie? Is it with all three? Because they're all saying, hey, 11 Labs says, hey, I'm just providing the software. It's now, we're going to put some guardrails, et cetera. Lingo says, hey, et cetera. And FCC has fined them, but this is going to get complicated and messy also along the way.
It does. And I think we're going to have to think long and hard at if you contribute to this effort to persuade people with misinformation, what is your liability going to be? You'd have to ask yourself, if you're being asked to imitate the president and the message that you're saying is sufficient, that you have to question whether or not, how is this being used? I mean, what is this being used for? I mean, you could always have any crime if it requires a chain of things to happen, whether or not someone involved in that chain could have reasonably been expected to know that something was going on that was inappropriate. And I, along this whole line, whether you're the person whose voice is being used or you're the company that's altering an audio file, you know what's being said. It has to occur to you that something here is in the commission of a crime or an act that's clearly unethical. So I think it's all along that chain. And it's not enough to say, well, I wasn't sure how they were going to use it. I mean, when it comes to the kinds of things that are overtly intended to misinform people, I think you have liability. And frankly, I think even, I know this is a different topic, but even when it comes to the giant tech platforms, I have great admiration for what they've done. But the liability shield that they were given a number of years ago by Congress at a time when they would say, well, we can't monitor everything that gets posted. Well, honestly, I think given the impact that they have on not just the country, but on the world, I think it's high time where they start to bear responsibility, at least for following their own guidelines. I mean, what I would do is require them all to have a series of guidelines about what can be posted. And when they are alerted to the fact that someone has posted something which violates those guidelines, they have an obligation immediately to investigate and remove that material. And failing their ability or their desire or their willingness to follow their own guidelines, I think would constitute a violation of law. So that I think we're going to have to get to someone recognizing the deadly nature of this information and this misinformation being posted, which now can get to literally millions of people in moments. I think we have to take a look at all this. That's a little bit off of this topic, but it all sort of comes together in the ways that technology is used to disseminate information.
Well, that leads me to two other questions, because you made some very interesting points, because they're kind of interrelated. Senator Josh Hawley, and I think Chris Murphy have a bill that kind of takes this shield away, so to speak, from these giant tech companies, social media companies. Are you in support of taking that shield away, Congressman?
Well, I'll have to look at their bill, so I don't want to sign off without knowing all the provisions of the bill. But I think what we could do is compel every platform to have standards, and the standards have to address misinformation, information which they know is factually untrue, then require them to make sure that they're monitoring their own sites and using their guidelines as the standard. So you could say, you have to develop a set of standards. Here are the minimum requirements for your guidelines. And then you have to follow them. So when you have a complaint, and some it's a credible complaint that something on the site violates your own standards, you have to take it down. And I'd also require them to have a much better record keeping of who's posting on their site. This idea that people say the most awful, horrendous things and hide behind the cloak of anonymity is just wrong. We're not only affecting adults, we're affecting pretty dramatically young people, children, preteens, who are now on social media far more a number of hours a day than I think any of us suspect. And there's been a fair amount of literature and research now going into the mental health impacts of this. So I think when this all began, the platforms were trying to grow, trying to get a foothold. It was new technology. I think we made a mistake in letting them get away and letting them get so big without any responsibility. I think it's time for us now to really rein that in and make sure that people are not engaging in activities which they know to be malign, that they know to be untruthful, without taking any action to rectify it.
So, Congressman, they became big and things have somehow gotten out of control. Do you have a fear, like a lot of our guests on the show, that same thing could happen with AI? I mean, you have four or five companies now controlling, because of the cost of building these large language models. You can count on one hand how many companies have that, and we could have the same situation. And now is our time to sort of act. Thoughts on that, Congressman?
Yeah, no, I agree. And I agree with other guests who said this, and it's certainly not unique to me. In many ways, I think we were so enamored with the technology that we were, and by that I mean the social media technology, that we were unwilling to step in. And I think often didn't maybe fully understand it and didn't appreciate how algorithms were tracking our movements and tracking the things that we liked or disliked or commented on, and the ability to gather all that data. I don't think we fully appreciated that. And in some ways, I think the social media phenomenon got ahead of Congress and got ahead of policymakers. I think we would be making an awful mistake to repeat that. So I think at the same time that we're looking at AI and the kinds of guardrails we ought to put on it and the development of it, I think we have to also look at social media, because to not do that unleashes the power of it in very dark ways. And look, I think there's two things we shouldn't kid ourselves about. One, this notion that we're going to stop people from developing AI models, I think is just wrong. I mean, you're never going to be able to stop, just like you can't stop innovation, nor would you really want to. So that's one of the fallacies. And the second is this mistaken idea that it's all dark. It is all used for the most ill of purposes. But AI can be extraordinary. It will transform healthcare. It will transform transportation, communications. I mean, all the things that we talk about that we want to do, AI can be an enormous tool. I mean, the speed at which it makes decisions and the speed at which it makes recommendations about new material compounds and the material sciences. I mean, the list goes on and on. Question is, how do we make sure, though, that it's in appropriate hands and we have these appropriate guardrails to monitor its development over the next several years and going out the decades ahead?
So, Congressman, you also sponsored another legislation called the No AI Fraud Act. Can you tell our listeners just the primary goals of this and what specific issues it aims to address, Congressman?
Looking to make the most out of AI advancements and innovation? Visit regulatingai.org to learn more about how best to optimize the use and integration of AI and sign up for the Regulating AI newsletter to keep up to date with the latest in AI governance and regulation.
Yeah, this again is trying to protect an individual's right to their likeness, their voice against the use of it in AI. It's not quite as broad as what I described I worked on in the New York legislature, which I wanted to try to have this as a property right. But effectively, it's getting at that. That's that your image, your likeness, your voice are really owned by you, and that people ought not to be able to use your image and your likeness without your consent. And I think this is going to be a larger and larger issue all the time. Some of it relates to, and look, the harm that can be done to people, the financial harm, the reputational harm, the trauma that can be brought upon a person when their image is used in a way which they didn't give authorization to be used. So it digs into that. And Madeline Dean and others who join me in the co-sponsorship, I think, are really trying to identify where the liability is and where the responsibility is for using image and likeness. I think some of this is fascinating. If you're the estate of Cary Grant and you want to put Cary Grant in a first-run movie and something that's consistent with his brand, I mean, I love Cary Grant movies, so I'd be looking forward to him being in another movie again would be astonishing. But you want him to be somewhere where the people who has his estate, who are family members, who want that done in an appropriate way. And for people who are living, even more so, that they should not have. If you're Robert De Niro, you don't want to see yourself in a movie that has your image in it and your likeness without your approval, because again, reputationally it could hurt you. And why should people make money off of your likeness and your personhood? So that gets at that as well.
Congressman, AI is evolving, as you said, so very rapidly. We had these chatbots, large language models, we have multimodal, now we have agents, now people are talking about AGI. Members of Congress in the same day have to deal with Ukraine, Hamas, border security, the budget. I mean, this is just 4 out of 40 things that I've talked about and probably on the same hour. How do we expect regulators, and obviously you have amazing staff, but given the nature of this technology, how are you going to make sure our regulations keep pace? Because you might regulate on something today, but AI is going to be something completely different a year from now.
I think it's really a great point, and I think people underestimate the challenge in that, which you just said, which is, it would have been hard even 5 years ago, if you think about it, Sanjay, it would have been hard for people to really think about where the technology would be in 5 years because you simply don't know. So how do you regulate a future that you don't know? I think you do it in a couple ways. One is you establish basic underlying principles, things that are values that you embrace and try to articulate those in statute. And the second is to not get locked into very specific kind of regulations that are based on certain fact patterns. And I'll say this because I've seen this in the past. For instance, I chaired a number of years ago when I was in the state legislature, the Committee on Insurance. And in the space of health insurance, for instance, there were certain protocols on certain illnesses on how to get reimbursement for this or that. But too often, we would have diagnostic tools or other things that would become no longer the standard of care 10 years later. And so you'd try to get insurance to cover certain new procedures. But because you had written in law very specific things, you were outdated. And so what it required was you'd have to continue to upgrade the technology or the standard of protocol or care. Instead, we want to have statutes that are, in a sense, living statutes that reference expertise or standards or manuals or protocols that exist. I mean, you just have to figure out how to do that. And that doesn't mean you won't make changes to the statute, but you don't want to get locked in with specific things or even specific language. If you had said computer-generated images 5 or 10 years ago, we would use that today. We would think that's outmoded language. And even artificial intelligence, which is sort of an interesting way to describe what we're doing. But to your point, it could be deep learning models. It could be neural networks. There are many ways to get at this. And look, we'll have quantum computing. And what does that mean in the AI world? when we fully see the convergence of AI, classical information theory, quantum computing, how will this all look and how will it all sound? So you really do want to talk about the values, principles, and then give yourself the latitude to continue to upgrade those in regulation so that they're consistent with the things you believe in. And look, you have to review this on an ongoing basis so that you don't find the language and law is outdated and no longer reflects the state of play. It's not easy. And honestly, I'll tell you what I've been doing. I've been reading a lot about artificial intelligence. I sort of understand on a sort of a primitive way computer programming, which is looking for certain values and returning something when it hits that value. AI is different, and I'm just trying to understand neural networks. So I've been reading a lot, get a lot of books out of the Library of Congress. I sat with four university professors at the University of Rochester last week to ask a lot of questions about how calculations are, or how predictability and probability in outputs are measured and how we use neural networks. And some of it is trying to replicate the human brain. In some cases, we use a different methodology. But how do we do this? How do we as policymakers make judgments about what should or shouldn't happen without necessarily fully understanding the technology that you're trying to regulate? It's not an easy task.
Well, firstly, kudos to you that you are learning and spending time and making yourself aware. Not everybody does that. Kind of leads me to another question, Congressman. And I ask this to a lot of our members of Congress. Do you think, because you talked about the pace of change technology, we need a separate independent regulatory body for AI like we have for the nuclear issue, for other issues? And I'll tell you it when you answer my question, what's the feedback I get from the members of Congress?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think, and I've had some conversations with folks in the administration about our R&D apparatus just generally. So the United States government is involved in a lot of research and development, a lot of scientific programs. I don't think we have an overarching strategy or office of strategic thinking around technology and its and innovation. I'd almost think about doing that first. I don't know whether you create a cabinet level position. There is sort of a science advisor for the president, but I think we're involved in a whole host of activities. I don't know that it's regulated. I don't know that people really have a full sense of the overall strategic direction of the United States when it comes to its investment in research and development. And that can be biology, chemistry, physics. In some ways, some of these are starting to be interdisciplinary as we learn more and more about particles and elements and all the sudden crazy things that I couldn't even imagine when I was in high school and college that we are now dealing with. So I think we need to have, if not necessarily a regulator, certainly an overall strategic direction for this country and its investment. And then you do need advice, I think, at the high level for not only members of the administration, for the president, but for Congress itself. And so I do think there's some value, certainly in making sure that we have an appreciation for the challenges that we face.
Yeah. And by the way, we've had the director of the National Science Foundation on our show, and they are doing some amazing things. And Steve is doing a lot of stuff on the safety things. So I'll give you the spoiler alert answer. Most members of Congress say, yeah, we need it, but it's not going to happen. It's too much bureaucracy. It's going to be very hard to stand up another agency. So
to that point, yeah, I feel like the book agent for this, but there's a book called Recoding America by Jennifer Palga. Jennifer's done a great job of talking about how policymakers at a high level come up with policy. And then when it comes to implementing it, it really gets lost in translation. And we need a much better job when it comes to technology and innovation of having policy set and then having people who are implementing do it in a way that it becomes, to your point, less bureaucratic, eliminating some of the layers that we have between policymaking and implementation. So I don't want to give up on the idea that we need to do this because I think it's essential and we need to be thoughtful about it. And frankly, I think, again, members of Congress, we tend to be generalists or people who are expert in one thing. But to the point you made earlier, when I get up in the morning and read the New York Times, the Washington Post, 10 minutes into reading it, I realize, wow, there's 50 things that I should be thinking of today, whether it's AI or what's happening internationally in the Middle East, what's happening in Ukraine, what's happening in Taiwan and China, what's happening to the international economy. I mean, there's so many things and you haven't even got started yet. So we need to have people around us who can really give us advice or dealing with it literally on a daily basis.
Shifting topic a little bit, Congressman, there have been all kinds of reports from IMF, from McKinsey, et cetera, that there is a major job transformation or upheaval ahead of us. There are some numbers predicting even 60%, 30%, 40%. But every guest I've talked to, I'm talking about industry and academics, have said there is going to be a major transformation ahead. You come from Rochester, a region that has seen its own changes because of time, evolution, et cetera. What should the U.S. government or someone like you be doing to prepare us? Because I talked to the NSF director, they're funding institutes, et cetera, but I am concerned that we are not really preparing. I talk to industry people and I say, we lose jobs because of AI. They say, no, the people who don't know AI will lose jobs to the people who know AI. So I am saying, the question then is, what is our responsibility, especially getting people in community colleges, et cetera? 40% of our population goes to community colleges. Everybody cannot afford a four-year college. And how do we get some of those people in rural and other areas also part of this so that they are not left behind? It creates societal issues. What is Congress, do you think, has a role in something like this, Congressman?
I do. I think it's a huge issue. A couple of thoughts I have just generally. In every age, in every time you've had technological shifts, it means there will be challenges in terms of the workforce. And that has always happened. It's moving at a faster pace, so it's creating concerns. But there are so many jobs now, even when you go to factories, that would not have existed 10, 15 years ago. People who are monitoring the robots that build things, those are all new jobs, right? So I think while I understand the fear, I also think this isn't a new fear. It's happened in every age in terms of when we shift, and innovation has always done that. The things that I think we do need to do, and I think community colleges play a huge role, to your point, because they're in communities, so they're near where the jobs are, and they can work much more nimbly with existing businesses to model curriculum. And it doesn't have to be degree-granting programs. It could be certificate programs, could be in-service kinds of education. But we should be thinking about this, and we should be really driving this. We should have every student in America understand basics of math, basics of verbal and written communication to continue to allow us to be more literate. We need to teach critical skills like critical thinking and how to be problem solvers and to be innovators, because it's not so much the material that you learn, it's how to process it. How do you continue to put that within your framework of what you know, both in terms of your lived and learned experiences, and how do you make sure that you continue to be, as an individual, valuable in the marketplace? I think we've gotten to the point where some people, they learn a skill and that's it. I mean, they're not going to worry about continuous learning. They're not going to try to do things that create in them more value in the marketplace. And I think it's both the responsibility of government, and I think it's responsibility of the private sector, but it's also the responsibility of individuals. So you shouldn't rely on anybody doing this for you as an individual. You should continually try to upgrade your skill sets and make them relevant. I think as a business, you need to be thinking about how nurturing your workforce and continuing to move them up the career ladder in terms of skill sets. And the government certainly has a role to play here, because we have to be thinking about, at a time in our country where the birth rate is low, we have a shortage of people in manufacturing and agriculture and construction and hospitality and healthcare. AI can help address some of those things, but we also need to work, and this is a whole different issue, on immigration to allow people who want to come to this country, who want to work, to be able to give them the skills that they can be successful. We need to have a much more progressive way of dealing with that, but I'm sure that's tied for another show. But I think it is an obligation of government to be a part of this and to work with the private sector and work with individuals to assemble the kinds of resources for them, make them available, kinds of incentives, which will prompt people to do it and give people an easy way to access information so they can continue to be relevant in the workplace.
Congressman, just shifting outside the United States, the EU has passed the EU AI Act through its parliament. And obviously, they been a little ahead of us in regulation, whether you look at GDPR, et cetera. We've kind of been behind. What do you think? Should we collaborate? Should there be a global framework? What are your thoughts? Or should we go it alone? China has its own thing. EU has its own thing. The African Union has its own thing. If you are a global company, you're going to have to deal with a mishmash. And then some states in the United States are kind of, California is doing its own thing. If you're a global company, either you employ a ton of lawyers trying to figure this out, or you are in a problem. Your thoughts, Congressman, on that?
Yeah, I think there has to be international cooperation. And there's no way that even individual states, in my mind, can effectively set up their own set of regulations. And to your point, particularly when it comes to some of these very large platforms and companies that are investing, because this is not an easy thing. While the technology might be much more accessible than it would have been 10 or 15 years ago, it's still, you have to generate enormous amounts of capital to be able to get in this in a real way. So much so that you're attracting some of the finest talent, by the way, is starting to really hurt the academic side and research world, because companies are paying significant sums to bring the brightest minds to bear. So I think the European Union, the African Union, and you can do this in the United Nations, probably is one of the best suited to be able to do this, but to really pull people together and establish some international standards, I think that's the safest way to go. It may also be the most difficult in some way, because there are cultural differences. There are clearly differences in terms of what an individual country's view is on where they sort of fall in the world stage. But having different standards and not just from nation to nation, but to your point, individual states, makes this really difficult. And you're going to find yourself that people will ultimately, as they do in a lot of other things, go to the place where there's the fewest impediments. But that doesn't mean that's the safest, because things move when you're talking about online. I mean, things move instantaneously across jurisdictions, and people aren't going to pay attention very much to physical borders or geographic borders if they don't have to. I think that makes the most sense. And the United States clearly can provide international leadership in the space. We lead in so many ways, but we don't have a monopoly on this. There's really smart people all over the globe that do very well in this space and are investing more in this space. So I think an international effort is necessary, but the Congress and the United States can help lead the way in this and bring people together.
Finally, Congressman, you are ranking on House administration. For our listeners, and I know OMB just issued last week a directive, can you tell our listeners how prepared or how is our U.S. government, the largest customer in the world, using AI? Because you have been talking about that in your hearings. I've heard you talk very eloquently about that, Congressman.
Yeah, we are starting to look at this really when it comes to what's the role of AI for members of Congress and staff in using it as a tool to get to the best policy outcomes. How do we make sure that there's cultural appropriateness, that we don't have undue bias in the way that algorithms are built? How do we use this and make sure that we're not in any way violating copyright? How do we make sure that the data sets that we build and we create as members of Congress, how do we make sure that there's privacy involved? Again, how do we make sure that we're not contaminating data for the outside world to look at? There's a lot here to think about. And if I'm lucky enough, fortunate enough to be chairman of the committee come January in the new Congress, this is going to be one of the most important topics that we consider as we move forward. And look, I appreciate the amount of time you've given me. This is really, I'm very grateful, and this is really an important conversation. I hope you'll have me back to continue talking about this as we move forward.
Well, absolutely. Some final words for our audience, Congressman, before you leave?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I think people should be more hopeful. I feel as though we've gotten to this dystopian world where we assume AI is out to destroy us. There's clearly some very thoughtful people who put up warning signs saying we need to be thoughtful, and they were absolutely right. But look, I think this technology can be transformative in great ways, and I talked a little bit about that. We just have to be mindful now, and this is the time to do it. Let's not let it get ahead of us where trying to put the toothpaste back in the tube is really hard to do. So we can waste no time in making sure that we have appropriate guardrails set up in government and out, because it's going to affect the life of every single American and, frankly, every person on the planet.
Congressman Morelli, thank you so much for joining us on Regulating AI and sharing your invaluable insights and expertise on this critical and important topic. Your contributions to the legislative efforts really have been instrumental. So thank you again for being on the show. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And thanks for all your contributions. These conversations are critical and appreciate you doing them and taking the time to make sure they get out to the world. Be well.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review.